From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Megan Mack.
And I'm Evan Dawson.
We had a special guest this week and a familiar voice for many longtime NPR listeners. Michelle Norris came to Rochester and was a guest on Connections. Norris is a journalist, the former host of NPR's All Things Considered, and the creator of the Race Card Project.
She was in town to talk to college students about race and culture and present the Race Card Project at Nazareth College. And we had the chance to talk to her about the Trump phenomenon and how to understand what we're seeing across the country.
People are divided in families, but also divided in work families. So there are workspaces. You know, we've talked a lot about the rallies where people go to work to go into a certain place with a Trump sticker right now. Is to get atta girls and atta boys from some people, but also to get people reacting with recoil in other spaces. So, you know, people have to figure out how to remain on the team, remain in the family, you know, and talk across difference. That's part of what is required. And it's not always valued in at a time where social media determines or dictates so much of how we communicate with each other, and where the media landscape is a place that is fractured in the way that it is, such that you can just listen to, you can subscribe to a media diet that just confirms what you already believe. So we're not well practiced in listening to someone else. And so, you know, maybe that is why people turn to the Race Card Project, because they can say things in a space where they won't face judgment or immediate retribution. And I post things. I mean, I tell people, if you go to the website, and I hope your listeners do, but I also warn them, when you go, and Evan, you probably saw this, you will see things that you will be offended. I can guarantee that when you go to that space, you will see someone whose name is attached to their six words, and sometimes even their picture, who has said something out loud that would make your head snap if you heard it in the cafeteria on campus, or if you heard it in the break room at work. But they demonstrated extreme courage in putting that statement out there. And I think there's value in putting that out there, not just to be provocative, mm-hmm. but to help people understand that if we're going to build a bridge, you need to understand the span. You need to understand the distance between those two places. And if we have any hope of building cultural bridges or political bridges or societal bridges, you need to understand the gulfs that separate us.
And what's the website, Michelle?
TheRaceCardProject.com.
It's really worth your time, though you could sink your whole afternoon on it, but it really is worth the time. I will also just mention on the fracturing of the country, Matthew Dowd, a political analyst, said last night, looking at the voters who voted yesterday, a third of Republican voters said, if Trump's the nominee, I will not vote Republican. But a third of Republican voters said, if Trump is not the nominee, I will not vote Republican. That is a real fracture, and that's not something that, you know, regardless of where your political stances are, I mean, that's potentially very serious for this country, not just the party, and it is worth talking about, as opposed to just lampooning or walling off. And, you know, tribalism in politics is potentially dangerous. All right, to the phones we go. Larry in Brockport first up. Go ahead, Larry.
Hi. I was going to make some comments, but to go along with the six words, how about white flight? Nowhere left to run. I think what is causing a lot of the angst amongst a certain portion of our population is the fact that there is nowhere left to run for those who feel that they want to or must or want to separate themselves from it. And I think that's what's fueling a lot of the people who are supporting Trump.
Larry, thanks for the phone call. Any panelists want to weigh in there? Michelle Norris, what do you think?
Well, and again, I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I'm afraid to tiptoe and actually mention the statistics. But if you look at the quick analysis of the voting patterns yesterday and from the previous Tuesday for Super Tuesday, much of Donald Trump's support does come from areas that are fairly racially homogenous, that, you know, pockets where there where white residents and white voters are in the overwhelming majority. I'm not sure if it means that they feel that they're cordoned off there because they have nowhere left to run. There's so much in that. I wish Larry was still on the line because there's so many questions I'd want to ask him about. Is it that people, what are they running from or what are they running to, and what are they looking for, within that statement? But it probably does speak to, some aspect of this moment, whether it's white flight or whether it's just the interest in people to live among people who share their values. And that gets us into really tricky territory, doesn't it? Because, on one hand, that's someone's right?
But and probably somewhat natural.
And people do, sort of retreat to their zones of comfort. But there are all kinds of it gets tricky because how then do you police that? And then what kind of policies go along with that? Because when you start to overlay housing values and access to education and the opportunities that go along with that, then it starts to get, really tricky. It's more than just a personal choice in that matter. And when you look at what people are running to or running from, or what really motivates their decision to surround themselves, with people of like mind or similar perspective, or in some cases skin color, that leads to a lot of things that can be uncomfortable but are probably necessary to confront and discuss.
Speaking of race, this week marked 8 years since President Obama delivered his famous speech on race in Philadelphia.
He was a senator at the time, running for president. You might remember he was dealing with questions about his association with Pastor Jeremiah Wright. His address in Philadelphia was titled A More Perfect Union, and it is widely considered his most important speech.
We asked community leaders to rewatch the speech 8 years later and then tell us, where have we made progress and where have we failed?
Adam McFadden, are we more segregated now than we were 8 years ago?
Absolutely, and I think we've seen what I would call an Obama backlash that occurred after the president got in, that in the media you began to see people's fears play out. Even the way that they addressed issues of color, it was almost like we could never deal with them honestly. So I absolutely believe that we have gone backwards.
Simeon Bannister?
Well, let me just say very quickly that I was a little bit torn. Coming on today, my dad passed away recently.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I bring it up because this is an issue that was very, very close to my father's heart, particularly kind of broadly speaking race, and particularly within the context of Obama. And I would even go so far as to say that what I kind of take away from my dad and his teaching me on this, at least, is that we've got to be grounded in historicity, right? There are things that actually happen. I think we have a way of looking at race in a very linear fashion, right? We were here and now we're here, and how do we measure the distance that we've come? And in fact, we have to look at it in a multifaceted way, right? There's some places where we've made progress, no doubt, and there's certainly some very significant ways that we've had some retrogression. And I think it does us a real service to look at the kind of specificity and to examine this thing as closely as possible to be able to identify, again, where we've made progress, where we've gone backwards. But we can't look at it in a unilateral way, I think.
Okay. Jim Shepard?
I think we definitely have not moved forward. We've had, like Simeon said, there's certain things we can say. People have moved a little bit. But if you look at, Trump's campaign, it really brings out where people stand. And I think that for years we've sort of been comfortable keeping things in the closet. And I think through his campaign, people are willing to step up and say, you know what, this is how I really feel. And I think that's what's being exposed right now.
Hmm. Van White?
Well, Simeon talked about his father, so that made me think about my father, who died about 25 years ago. And he, too, was a person who's committed to Rochester. And I would agree with Simeon, not only in terms of looking at this from a personal perspective, what our fathers taught us, but what we saw when our fathers were here. And I think that compels us, at least compels me to say, some things are the same and some things are different. I mean, when my father was running the Carey Organization, which was an organization that sought to diversify Xerox, or when he was chair of the Urban League here in Rochester, at that time, you didn't have a city council that was predominantly people of color. Mm. You certainly didn't have a school board that was predominantly people of color. And so you got to acknowledge that change. And you certainly didn't have a president of the United States that was a president of color. But at the same time, those issues that my father was fighting against, and Simeon's father and other people in this room, and their fathers and grandfathers, some issues they're still dealing with today. So I think we have to be a little more sophisticated in our assessment, but no doubt there are some things that are very frustrating. There are some things that keep me in business as a lawyer, because, and those are the things that people were suing about 20 years ago at companies throughout this community. So some things are the same and some things are better.
If you want to watch the entire speech on race from 2008, there's a link to the video attached to this podcast.
All right, there's no easy way to transition from that subject, but let's try. This week we welcomed Dr. Michael Greger, who wrote a book called How Not to Die, and it is really all about what we eat.
Dr. Greger was in town to speak to the Rochester Academy of Medicine, but first he came to Connections to get specific about why a plant-based diet can not only prevent disease, it can cure them.
He also talked about his own transition to plant-based eating 26 years ago.
It's so much more easy, so much more convenient, so much more socially acceptable. What isn't different is the science. We knew the science back then, we knew the science now, and that's the tragedy. So what did it for me was July 1990, when Dr. Dean Ornish published his lifestyle heart trial in the most prestigious medical journal in the world, proving for the first time there in black and white something called quantitative angiography, proving that you can open up arteries without drugs, without surgery, effectively the cure to the number one killer of men and women. Since that day, no one else should have died of heart disease, yet hundreds of thousands of people continue to perish from this preventable, treatable, reversible condition. That's the real tragedy. We've had the science, we've had it for decades, yet people continue to die.
And so Dean Ornish was what changed you.
Dean Ornish did what did it for me.
25 years ago, what changed you, Ted?
Dean Ornish.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. We were thinking about making the switch for environmental reasons at the time. And then Dean Ornish's book came out on reversing heart disease. And he talks about how difficult it is to get funding for anything to do with lifestyle. So medical research for lifestyle is not supported by pharmaceutical companies or, you know, the manufacturers of medical equipment. So I had what I call my sloping forehead moment, which is when I can't see that on the radio, but I hit myself on the forehead. Of course, it makes sense. It's like an aha moment, right? You say, well, that makes perfect sense, because all these very expensive things that we use to treat people have a constituency in industry, whereas getting people to eat right has very little constituency. There's no broccoli lobby, really.
Well, and I don't want to derail into something too political, but I do want to ask this, because I know Dr. Greger has mentioned this in prior interviews. You know, I think it bears asking why 25 years later, 26 years later, why is it that this is now starting to take hold? As opposed to, like you said, the day that Dean Ornish came out with this, you thought, okay, the light switch is on. In a profit incentivized system, there is less of an incentive for real advocacy for preventive or curative diet like this. In other words, there's more money in status quo. I mean, do you feel that way?
Yeah, although there's certainly still a lot of ignorance now. I mean, doctors have a severe nutrition deficiency in education. I mean, we just weren't taught this in medical school. This whole body of evidence on using lifestyle interventions
to reverse disease. Is that getting better?
I would like to think that, but certainly, I mean, the last national survey of medical schools here in the country, which I think was 2006, so it's still a little dated now, found that only a quarter of medical schools offer a single dedicated course in nutrition.
Let's wrap up with something familiar and maybe something terrifying. Those strings are from the 1960 horror film Psycho.
This coming Tuesday, the Little Theater is showing Psycho, followed by a discussion about how filmmakers use editing and other techniques to manipulate our emotions.
So we welcomed film professor Les Friedman and psychology professor James Cutting to discuss how Psycho broke new ground and how it helped change psychological thrillers. Here they are talking about the impact of the film's score, especially in that famous shower scene.
Dr. Cutting, you had that shower scene without the sounds, and the actual sounds, I think, became known as the murder. But if you had it without the strings, those iconic strings now, what do you think the difference in terms of psychological impact would be, Dr. Cutting?
I think it would be tremendous. I mean, Bernard Herrmann's music is just astonishing. But what I can say is that there is a lot of Psycho in which it is silent. And that's true in many Hitchcock films, where Hitchcock is clearly using the silence to put people on edge, basically. I mean, people are so used to music coming in now and again. I mean, the data that I have say that for the average film, there's music on in the background. We call it non-diegetic film music, and it's on about half the time. And I haven't looked at my data recently. I did look at Psycho and how much music it has, and it actually doesn't. There's a lot of blank space there, and Hitchcock uses it tremendously well. But then, of course, the shower scene, and there are many other scenes as well, particularly when they go up to the house on the hill. It's just full of this Bernard Herrmann wonderfully edgy stuff.
Les, what do you think would have been the difference without the music in the shower scene?
I think Dr. Cutting's absolutely right. I think the music is absolutely crucial here. I'm amazed to hear that he didn't think about it, because he's used Herrmann. You know, he understands music, so it would have been a very, very, very different scene. I can't quite imagine it.
And that does it for another edition of Weekend Connections. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
I started the music wondering if it would trip you up midstream.
I'm a pro now.
You are a pro now. I cannot trip her. You can also find us on WXXI.org/listen and on the WXXI mobile app. From all of us at Connections and Weekend Connections, I'm Evan Dawson, she's Megan Mack. Have a great weekend.